Hello and welcome to the Ropescast, the independent voice of the Middle East. I'm Ksenia Svitlova.
And I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmed. ROPES stands for the Regional Organization for Peace, Economics and Security. We are a young organization that laid the groundwork for a post-conflict Middle East by connecting forward-thinking Israeli and Palestinian emerging leaders with like-minded peers from across the region. If you're looking for more information on ROPES, please visit our website, ropes.org.
Our special guest today is Dani Ayalon, an Israeli diplomat, columnist, and politician. He served as deputy foreign minister and a member of Knesset. He was the Israeli ambassador to the United States from 2002 until 2006. Previously, he worked as senior foreign policy advisor to Prime Ministers Ariel Sharon, Ehud Barak, and Benjamin Netanyahu. Dani Ayalon is also the president of Hod Ayalon, a private consulting firm for governments and international corporations, and the chairman of the Silver Road Capital, an investment banking firm for business owners and companies. Hi, Dani, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ksenia. Always good to be with you.
Thank you so much. Well, actually, there are so many issues that are on the agenda right now, and we want to discuss with you today. But first of all, let us begin with the macro, and then we'll dwell into the details. The famous statement has it that Israel has no foreign policy. Do you think that it's true? And simply because every aspect of foreign policy, as we also see today, after the events of 7-10, is interconnected with domestic affairs and primary Israeli security.
Well, I would shamelessly say, unfortunately, that at this period, Israel has only domestic policy, and we see it quite evident at the stance that the government take or doesn't take vis-a-vis the day after the Gaza war that started in the horrible massacre of Hamas terrorists on the 7th of October. I would say in the past, we had periods with statesmen as leaders and sometimes politicians. When you have a statesman as a politician or as a head of state, like Rabin was, like Begin was, they took, I would say, the priority of foreign affairs or the Israeli strategic interest over domestic. Today, unfortunately, this is not the case, and we have a composition of government with two far-right parties that actually do not allow the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, to move ahead, and he is quite willingly happy to sit and not take any major decisions as long as he is, I would say, safe in his seat as a Prime Minister.
So basically what it means is that when Netanyahu talks to, for example, Biden, then he thinks not about what is the purpose that he should serve right now, but what about his base will think at home?
Well, absolutely, because certainly the Israeli national interest, security interest, is to bring about a new geopolitical architecture in the Middle East. And today it is within reach. Because of the new attitude by the Saudis following the Abraham Accords with Bahrain and with the Emirates, Morocco, other countries. Of course, the long-term relationship with Egypt and Jordan. Things can be done. Of course, Israel will also have to relate to the issue of the Palestinians. This is the big elephant in the room that you cannot circumvent it. And The fact that we are not even discussing it, not even in a public discourse, I think it is a real missed opportunity. And if we'll have time, I can elaborate more about how do I see the key to the future of Israeli Palestinians and what is their role within the region.
And so with that, how exactly did the dynamics of the Israeli policy change since October 7th? What has become, I would say, more difficult? Aside, obviously, the Israeli-Palestinian topic, like you said, it's a no discussion. But what else is becoming more difficult after the 7th?
Well, I think, again, the Israeli politics today is not very nuanced, and it has to be nuanced, because on the one hand, after October 7th, the term of a Palestinian state sounds very threatening, you know, and it's quite understandably so. But if we break it down to time, over time, and the ingredients, then things can be more, amenable to the Israelis. One thing is certain, and that is that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict must be addressed, and you cannot ignore it. And unfortunately, when you ignore it, when you don't take the decisions, others take the decisions for you. And at this point, the ones that took the decisions for us are the most extreme radical elements, starting in Tehran, the Ayatollahs of Tehran, with their proxies. Hamas, which started this war on the 7th of October, with Hezbollah acting up, and of course all the Iranian militias in the region, the Houthis, and they are now, commanding the situation. They are the ones determining the future, and we cannot allow that. And I believe that if we arrange a network of the moderate countries, not the extreme countries, we can create a major alliance which can counter the radicalism in the Middle East and bring the entire region into a new era.
Well, Danny, the more I think about it, then of course, what you say, it resonates so much with, for example, what our organization stands for, because we firmly believe that there could be no regional process of reconciliation if it will not include the Palestinians. So this is something that you cannot even envisage. But for so long, Israeli government, as you correctly said, overlooked it, and especially weakened, the more pragmatic elements and funded, and supported the more radical elements. And it brought us all of this neglect and this double game that backfired, of course, on us here, the Israelis. It brought us to unexpected, processes like the process in Hague. How do you evaluate it, Danny? Because, I think that if somebody would ask, the average Israeli, after the massacre of 10/7, can you imagine that in 3 months from now, Israel would have to stand in Hague, in court, and explain that it did not perform a genocide against the Palestinians? Could you imagine that? Do you think that it's a really big blow to the Israeli policy altogether?
Well, we see that it really doesn't concern the far-right parties, but I would say the Israeli mainstream certainly is concerned about it. And of course, the interim injunction or the interim decision of The Hague, was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, of course, it did allow Israel to continue with its self-defense, the right for self-defense. At the same time, we need to submit reports that I believe are not really compromising the Israeli position or Israeli doing, because anyway, everybody knows here that it's preposterous that we have been, conducting any kind which is even close to genocide. So I think we, on the legal ground, we will be okay. However, the political one is what concerns me, because the long-term ramification is that if you put Israel in the same sentence with Hague and genocide, it is another level of trying to delegitimize Israel, giving more fuel to the BDS movements. And this is something that Israel cannot tolerate. It's not that we can sit back and relax, and there are a lot of things to do about it, but we are outnumbered in the international arena, and this is something that certainly we have to take into account. To the extent, and this is very important to say, to the extent that it doesn't infringe on our security and the well-being of the Israeli public and population. Because the way I see Hague is part of the political warfare that the Palestinians have waged on us. And here, I think there is almost a division of labor between Hamas perpetrating the terror on the ground and the Palestinian Authority, with Mr. Abu Mazen, actually conducting what we call the political warfare, which has now morphed also into a legal warfare. So all these issues will have to be addressed when we talk about living together, because my basic assumption is that there is no other substitute to living together side by side, Israel and the Palestinians. Later on, we can talk about different modalities, but with coexistence, with security, with prosperity, with justice, with dignity to everyone. I think this should be the basic rules. How do we reach it? This is, of course, you know, we say God or the devil is in the details, but I think we can work it out.
So, you know, you mentioned devil, so let me be for a second an advocate for the devil, yes? You mentioned in the beginning the extreme right-wing Israeli government that exists right now, and that pushed aside every hand of help of the Americans, of the Europeans, and did so many wrongdoings in regards to the Israeli-Palestinian process, that there is a stalemate, you know, during all of these years, and it brought us to where we are today. So I know that in your biography, there is, I read it carefully, there is also a history of advocacy for Israel. You actually were one of the founders, if I'm correct, of advocacy organizations that defend Israel. And I want to ask you, Dani, how do you feel right now defending Israel despite the existence of the most extreme right-wing government that was ever, you know, ruling our country? How do you feel, you know, for example, going abroad, meeting people and still defending Israel, defending your country, although, you know, that there is this big elephant in the room, Netanyahu's government?
Yes, well, it's becoming increasingly more difficult. You have to start by explaining the convoluted political, I would say, system here in Israel, which allows small parties to actually be the balance and extort and really lead the way and maybe even force the government to go their way. Of course, in order to look back, you can say, well, the prime minister has the overall responsibility and he is the one who built this coalition government. So to that, there is no good answer, because Netanyahu could have built the government with a different composition of parties. And I think this was in the cards, but he did not want to do it. And the fact that he did not want to do it, it's legitimate from Israel constitutional, although we don't have a formal constitution, but it is legal in Israel from a constitutional point of view, from a legal point of view. So this is I would say, a given that you cannot go around. I think that today, and I look, for instance, at the Biden administration, which there's no lost love between them and Netanyahu and his government, but still, their support to Israel in real terms is immense, overwhelming. And why is it? Because they distinguish between the government of Israel and the state of Israel, or the people of Israel, which are a great asset for the United States from a moral, ethical, and of course, a strategic defense and everything else with it. So I think that if you look into the Israeli, I would say, civil society, if you look at the pluralistic nature of the Israeli political system, that alleviates somewhat the damage that we get internationally from the right, the far right parties in the government.
So, and you mentioned that you know, it's becoming increasingly difficult to talk about and try to defend Israel, you know, on the international scene now more than before. So, you know, now we see the nature of the relations with the South Africa and how stained they become. What other countries, actually, I would say, gave Israel the cold shoulder? Did any of them surprise you?
Well, I would say that there are those, you know, the usual suspects, of course, are Muslim countries. Of course, not all of them are Arabic. I would say one salient example, of course, is Turkey. Of course, you hear Jordan. The rhetorics from Jordan and from Egypt, of course, is not very pleasant, but we take it because we understand, again, the complexities of the internal situations in both these countries. So I would say that if you neutralize Arab and Muslim countries, which is quite natural for them to show solidarity with the Palestinian people, although many of them were shocked by the massacre on the 7th, many of them are saying even out loud that this is not the Islamic way. It was important to hear that. But if you take aside the Muslim world, I would say that most of the Western world was squarely with Israel. And although they do look differently at the operation in Gaza, but the solidarity with Israel in the first weeks after the massacre was unprecedented. I do not remember such support since maybe 73 war or even before. But this is not something that we can really cash on when it comes to the future, because Israel's right for self-defense is something which is a given, and all Western countries say it and continue to say it. We have, of course, another group of countries, mostly Asian countries, which are pretty much distant to the situation. China is a, I would say, an ally, certainly an economic ally of Iran, unfortunately. So we are not hearing much from them. On the other hand, the counterweight to that is India. And India has become a very, very strategic, I would say, partner for Israel, Japan, South Korea. So I would say it's a mixed bag. Still, we are outnumbered in the international community. We are outnumbered when it comes to member states of the United Nations, even the Security Council. And we saw that actually the Security Council already a month ago, actually in two different resolutions, tried to impose a ceasefire on Israel before they do away with the terrorism of Hamas. And the only two countries, actually it was vetoed by the United States, UK abstained. But you see that still the United States is the indispensable country and ally for Israel.
And following up on that, and the peculiar position, I would say, of the UK, what's your thought and your take on David Cameron's announcement about a possible recognition of a Palestinian state by the UK?
Well, this is quite amazing. This is not the official position of the UK, and I don't think they have really looked into it in details. I'll tell you, the issue of a Palestinian state, and first and foremost, the British, you know, with their long history of diplomacy, would know it.
Oh, that, yeah.
Right now, the Palestinian Authority, let's say, or the Palestinian as a whole, certainly Hamas, cannot, you know, do not check any of the boxes of the characteristics actually of a recognizable state by the United Nations. And so this is more of maybe a wishful thinking. I know the British diplomacy, and they're very pragmatic. So I'm trying to think, why did the foreign minister, Mr. Cameron, said what he did, without being embarrassed, because it's not going to be coming soon. And I think what he did was, we have to look at the timing. The timing of the statement was a day after this, I would say, bizarre gathering in Jerusalem, again, of the far right parties talking about the return to Gaza. So I think this
the
was
return, kind of, let's, for the sake of our listeners, just emphasize the return of Israeli settlements and settlers to Gaza, not just the return metaphoric to Gaza, but they actually try to dream to revive the lost Gush Katif settlements and whatever.
And expand others.
Yes, and build others.
Exactly. So I think what Cameron did was a signal, not to these parties, because there is no common ground between him and the far-right parties here, but a signal to the Israeli government, mainly to Bibi Netanyahu, that could be the international community reaction if Israel government supports such a move. Not that it does, because Netanyahu already rejected this idea, but still, I think you see that there is not much trust and confidence in what the prime minister is saying. And again, it's unfortunate. So I think Cameron found it necessary to have a strong signal about Israel not staying in Gaza.
Let's go and perhaps switch the region from UK to the position of the Arab and Muslim states. You mentioned, of course, that it's something that you expect. Quite frankly, Danny, you know, I was following very closely, and at some point I felt that the rhetorics, anti-Israeli rhetorics of Ireland, for example, was much more aggressive and vicious than that of the Arab countries around us. But apart from that remark, I would like to ask you a question about Turkey. In your opinion, what does Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, wants? I mean, he continues with the trade. He's blamed by the opposition even that he still allows the trade while people that he, you know, incites them against Israel, they boycott the Starbucks and they crush the Kentucky Fried Chicken or whatever. So what is the end game here? You know, how do you read this? Does he just want to get away from this incitement to take off people's mind of things, or is there something deeper?
Well, I think there are a few aspects or a few layers. I mean, we can dig down into it. I think the most obvious one is the personality of Erdogan and his political persuasion, and it's a religious persuasion and ideology. You know, until Erdogan came into power, I believe it was in 2001 or 2002, Israel was a strategic partner with Turkey, and the military intelligence cooperation was very, very close. Erdogan, I would say, almost single-handedly changed the paradigms of relationship between Israel and Turkey. One is on the basis of his religion ideology. You know, he belongs to the AKP party. The AKP party actually is part of the larger world movement of the Muslim Brotherhood, which Hamas is also part of. So we have to remember that he represents Muslim Brotherhood, except he is a Turkish Muslim Brotherhood and not an Arab Muslim Brotherhood, but the idea is the same. So it's from a very, very radical position that he takes his or expresses his views. Secondly, I believe that he thought that he could reach a Muslim leadership all over, you know, Arab and non-Arab countries, if he was bidding on Israel and using Israel as an instrument to galvanize Muslim support around him. It wasn't very successful, but he was still trying. And then the third layer, I would say, internal politics in Turkey, we have noticed that every time before elections, it becomes easier for him to attack Israel. However, having said that, we see that they do not actually go as far as you mentioned, as far as severing real volume of relationship in terms of the economy and commerce. And here, I think that there is a great interest for both Turkey to continue that. Also, Turkey has a very major concern, a strategic concern. This is about energy and the energy structure that will take place in the coming years, since Israel has now under its position a lot of natural gas in the eastern basin of the Mediterranean, in our economic waters. And since Europe is in dire need of this natural gas, especially after the war of Russia and Ukraine stopped the supply from Russia, Turkey would like to be a conduit of this natural gas to Northern Europe. Of course, they have to compete with Greece and Cyprus, but they have not given up. By the way, before the 7th of October, we saw for the last 12 months a charm offensive, a diplomatic charm offensive by Erdogan, who even invited Herzog, the Israeli president, to Turkey. And the idea, from his point of view, was to convince Israel to cooperate and do joint ventures, pipes and LNG and many other infrastructure that would be jointly built between Israel and Turkey for Europe. So this is also something which is in the back of his mind. So you see that he has a lot of considerations, but unfortunately, when push comes to shove, he's the first one to condemn Israel.
And, you know, looking at this dynamic, especially in the Middle East, and as you mentioned, the Arab states and the Muslim states' position after the war, how do you evaluate the damage that's been happening to the Abraham Accords? And actually, and you know, talking about that, what does that do to Netanyahu's logic that he always had of, you know, let's make peace with the Arab states and the Palestinians will follow because they will have no other choice? Because that rhetoric sounds like it's pretty much done for. Am I right?
Well, I would say that the Abraham Accord have proven to be quite solid, and they have surmounted this big challenge of the 7th of October. You see, no country of the Abrahamic Accord changed its relations with Israel, even the rhetoric, Morocco aside. But the Gulf states' rhetoric was, I would say, the most moderate in the Arab world vis-a-vis the operation in Gaza. So I believe at this point, they still bet on an American involvement and leadership in the Middle East. And this is very important. And this is why the Gaza operation is very important, because right now we are in a very, very major and crucial juncture in the Middle East. I would say in the entire world, even the Americans, from their point of view, they see that Americans, let's say, standing in the world, Americans' interests in the world are also worldwide. And we don't have time to elaborate. If you have any question, I would be happy to. But they see American interests also at a major juncture. And here in the Middle East, we can turn into the American way, I would call it, whereby we extend the Abraham Accord, Saudi Arabia coming, bringing in a lot of investments, creating a corridor, an economic corridor between Asia and Europe through the Middle East with the countries involved. And here, you know, you can have Jordan involved and, of course, Saudi Arabia and Emirates and Bahrain, Egypt, all this. If we do that, and also I think that also we should take into consideration the Palestinian peace here. Absolutely. Palestinians, even in Gaza, you know, which has a great opening into the Mediterranean, can also enjoy that. This is one way. The other way is the Iranian way. And the Iranian way, of course, is the hegemony of radical Shia Muslims using, you know, really a backward politics. And I would say creating almost police states and proxies, which would be clients of Iran, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Lebanon, and they would like also Syria, of course, they would like the other Sunni countries to do the same. This is why I believe the Sunni countries so much now try to align themselves with Israel, understanding that Israel is not the problem. Israel is the solution against the backward and the very dangerous Middle East that can be ruled by Iran. This is why I believe the whole world should continue to support Israel, because in order to bring about a new Middle East, which is a moderate, stable, prosperous Middle East, we need to do away with the radical elements, and first and foremost, with Hamas at this point.
So, Danny, that brings us to my last question, although I have a long list of questions that I prepared for you, maybe in the next podcast. But for now, I'd like to ask you also about November, because this is coming very soon. And in general, what kind of leadership will it take to indeed reach the Middle East, the new Middle East, to carve a new future for our turbulent but still very beautiful and unique region, the Middle East?
This is the most important question, Xenia. You know, who will lead the United States and what path they will take? Because if you look objectively at the United States' capabilities, strategic and economic and technology and science, everywhere that every measure, they are the one, and I would say almost only superpower. If you take Russia and China together and Iran together, they are not matched to American capabilities. No other country has 11 carriers, you know, aircraft carriers that can control the seas. No one has the capabilities of and the technological advance of the United States. Not all of them are shown. The United States, I can tell you from being in Washington, they have always tried to be at least a generation ahead technologically, on military technology, ahead of anyone else. And they're not sharing some of this technology with anyone, not even with their best friends, UK or Israel or Australia. So what I'm saying here, that they have the capability to really overcome any threats coming from China, Russia, and Iran, of course, and their proxies. However, it's not a matter of capabilities only. It's a matter of political will. And at this point, I'm not seeing a political will of the United States to exert its influence or at least to, let's say, corroborate their influence through means that are, I would say, concrete on the ground. So this is why we see that Iran is flagrantly attacking the Americans, although it's through the proxies, but everyone understands, and the United States is absorbing. And I'm afraid here, you know, if we look at the history, democracies, you know, they would try everything to avoid war. But by doing that, sometimes they prevent small wars and falling and creating a big war. This is the danger that I see right now with the American policy with Biden, who has these constraints of the campaign. If he becomes a second-term president, that could change. On the other hand, if Mr. Trump becomes also a second-term president, he could be an isolationist. He can sell the Ukraine down the river. He can withdraw political support from Taiwan or from South Korea. That means that, you know, Israel also has to be a little bit more apprehensive. Although in the case of Israel, it's different because the people around him and the evangelical community are, you know, attached, I would say, even sentimentally and emotionally with Israel. But that could be a totally different world if the United States is withdrawn to its own domestic politics.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see to what will be happening. Dani Aylon, it was great having you on the show. Thank you very much for coming.
Bar salama.
We have to do it again, that's for sure. There's so much to ask.
Absolutely. Hey.
Hi, Dani. Thank you. You've been listening to The Ropescast, the independent voice of the Middle East. Our guest today was Dani Aylon, an Israeli diplomat, publicist, and advisor. I hope you enjoyed The Ropecast. Our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and all quality podcast platforms. We are very grateful to all our listeners in the Middle East, Europe, the US, and other parts of the world.
You can support our work by small donation. More details on our website, ropes.org. We also invite you to follow ropes.org on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads to find out more about our work with the emerging leaders of the Middle East. I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmad.
And I'm Ksenia Svetlova.
Shalom.
And salam.